The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Lee Phillips is a science writer and EU affairs journalist. He's returning this week. His writing has appeared in Nature, The Guardian, Scientific American, and The Daily Telegraph. And this week we continue our conversation about his book, Austerity, Ecology, and the Collapse Porn Addicts, which is coming from Zero Books in October. Again, this is a second part of a two-part conversation. According to Phillips, modernity is not the cause of climate change and the wider bio-crisis, rather it's a solution. There is no uncorrupted nature to return to, and instead of shutting down and retreating into the brush, we need to rethink and revise the basis for our own development. It's Wednesday, September 9th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of Zero Squared and the publisher of Zero Books. In this episode, you'll hear from Tim and Eric, Charles Manson, National Lampoon, Dr. Roger Summons, the YouTube star Walter John, Bill Nye the Science Guy, and Neil deGrasse Tyson. You'll also hear music from Dan Lett. In fact, the music you're listening to right now is Lett's Bossa Muda. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Lee Phillips and I discuss new developments.
You know, as a result of widespread concern about nuclear, unnecessary concern about nuclear power, many people were, tens of thousands of people were evacuated from the surrounding area. And what we know now is that there was an increase in heart attacks and early deaths by elderly people who, you know, were utterly frightened moving away from their home. These were unnecessary deaths. There is absolutely no reason why these people needed to be moved. So it's actually the anti-nuclear fearmongers that have deaths on their, blood on their hands, in that they have created an international ideological climate where people are so afraid of nuclear power that this sort of unnecessary movement of fragile people is happening, and people are dying as a result of this. If you look, the best way to look at nuclear power is to have a look at the number of deaths per terawatt hour of all of the different sources of energy that we have. And coal, far and away, is the worst because, of course, air pollution. But nuclear power just doesn't even fit into the graph almost. It's so low, the number of people who've died as a result of nuclear power. It's lower even than solar power. And I ask, well, how on earth can people die from solar power?
Panels fall on them or something.
There's a couple of things. One is, of course, that there's a lot of heavy metals used in the production of solar panels. And the second thing, actually, the main reason is people just actually falling off their roof trying to put on solar panels. So that's how dangerous nuclear is. It is less dangerous than people putting solar panels on their roof.
Okay, now just to be the devil's advocate here, I want to be with you on this, but I just, I've grown up with a lot of indoctrination myself, I guess. The fear, I think, with nuclear power is that because the energy is so long lasting and it seems so powerful, that if something goes wrong with nuclear power, it could go wrong in a catastrophic way. It's kind of like the same fear of flying. It's like, yeah, I understand. I'm not going to die in an airplane, most likely. You know, the numbers are more people die crossing the street or going to the bathroom in their own home. But still, if the plane goes down, everybody dies. If I slip in the bathroom, I might survive, And that's kind of the fear with nuclear powers. It's like
but there's two responses to that. The first is even that may have been true decades ago. But even then, because of the low number of deaths, we still must choose that. I mean, it's a sort of utilitarian argument, and I have problems with utilitarianism in general because of, you know, the classic arguments around, well, every human is important. But put that aside for a moment. On a day-to-day basis, we usually work on a sort of rough utilitarian basis, and even if that were still true, it would still make sense in terms of risk analysis to opt for that option. To go for that option. But this comes back to the VHS argument I was making before, is it's just not even true anymore. Meltdown, what we're talking about here is meltdown. The fight today, if anti-nuclear activists were serious about paying attention to the research, is they should be fighting for a transformation of the remaining plants that still have the older technology and an update to modern third or fourth generation nuclear plants, which just physically can't melt down, just doesn't work that way. The physics of them, it can't happen.
Okay, well, that's, yeah, okay, so there you go. So without the fear of meltdown, nuclear power really doesn't have that kind of cataclysmic, apocalyptic association anymore.
And related to this, I mean, why nuclear is an important question for the left to be putting forward is that, and in my book, I mount a left defense of nuclear power. There's been a whole series in the last couple of years, a number of environmentalists who've put forward a defense of nuclear power, but nobody's put, as far as I've come across, nobody or very few people have put forward a robust left-wing defense of nuclear power. And the argument I make is that the fastest decarbonization process that any country has undertaken so far is France from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s when they went full bore for nuclear power. Now, what enabled, if you look at the research here, analyzing what enabled France to do this so quickly, every single analyst, and these aren't progressives, these are just, you know, energy analysts, they make a clear argument that what was crucial was it had to be a public sector endeavor, it had to be centralized, that they were lucky to achieve this before the transformation of the liberalization of energy markets in the European, what would become the European Union at the time, the 80s, the EEC. Mm-hmm. That basically put a halt to further expansion of French nuclear power. The reason, simple reason is it's incredibly advanced technology. So you do have to have a sort of open source or centralized public attitude to the development. It has to be taken under one umbrella. And secondly, much more importantly than that, is it's incredibly expensive to the construction costs are huge, just like the construction costs of hydroelectric. They're huge. In the long run, because the fuel is very, 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 very cheap, both hydroelectric and nuclear are incredibly cheap energy sources.
Yeah,
cheaper than almost any other energy source. It's the initial construction costs that are scary to the private sector. That's why it has to be public sector driven. And this is why the people, it's interesting, this is why right-wing free market think tanks like the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute and even the Economist magazine, the Free Market Economist magazine, are opposed to nuclear. I mean, the Economist is sort of hot and cold on this, but the reason they're opposed to nuclear is because they recognize that the only way that it is doable is either through a public sector, a straightforward public sector build-out, or significant public sector subsidies with significant public sector oversight and regulation. And they just don't like that. And so they're much happier with they're much happier with renewables than they are with nuclear power and hydroelectric. And so it's about time that the left sort of recognized the renewables argument for the neoliberal argument that
okay.
it is.
Let's talk about GMOs, though. I mean, you maybe you can convince me about how, you know, we can have nuclear power. I can imagine something from the Sharper Image catalog being shipped into the nuclear plant and replacing the bad part that used to melt down with something that looks shiny and new. So it works now. Okay. But GMOs are going to kill us.
But traditional breeding of food crops takes plenty of human intervention. Agricultural scientists have been tinkering with our food for centuries. That's why most of the food you eat cannot be found in nature. So watermelon, tomatoes, plums, and corn bear little resemblance to their original natural species. But now scientists can take it another step.
What most people don't know, but they should, is that practically every food you buy in a store for consumption by humans is genetically modified food. There are no wild seedless watermelons. There's no wild cows. There's no long-stem roses growing in the wild, although we don't eat roses. It's called artificial selection. That's how we genetically modify them. So now we can do it in a lab, and all of a sudden you're going to complain?
We as a species, we've been genetically modifying plants and animals for 10,000 years since the advent of agriculture. That's what that agriculture
is. Look how bad things are. No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, actually, this is where Derek Jensen will say, well, yeah, okay, you have a point there. There's fundamentally the advent of recombinant DNA technology in the 1970s is a leap forward, absolutely. But if anything, it's much more precise than the artificial selection breeding that went before. I mean, the arguments that the green left will say is we just don't know. I mean, what could happen? We're messing with nature. Well, you know, when we stick a couple of dogs together to come up with some new breed or whatever, we're messing with so many more genes and we have no idea what the result will be. Then the very very the hyper precision of genetic engineering. So if the argument, I mean, to the reality is that there may be some problems there, absolutely, but that's what regulation and safety trials and that framework is very rigorous to make sure that there aren't testing for allergens and so on and so forth. There is no sort of regulatory regime to make sure that the same is the case with regular breeding. And here's the thing. Again, the fundamental problem as a progressive that we have to have about this is that, I mean, there's a couple of arguments here. One is there are real issues in terms of with agribusiness. I am no celebrant of capitalist agribusiness, but we have to focus on the real problems, which are the relations of production and distribution. That's the issue, not the forces of production, not the technology. And by focusing on the technology, we're ignoring the real issues. Right now, there's all sorts of horrible things that Cargill and BASF and all of the big agribusiness firms that you could eliminate genetic GMOs tomorrow, and they would still be fucking over small farmers. It's a distraction at best, and at worst, what we have is we're preventing farmers, and I mean there are other applications of genetic technology as well, GMO mosquitoes that could eliminate mosquitoes. The humanity's ancient enemy that is responsible for millions of deaths every year from infectious disease and hundreds of millions of infections. There's so many benefits that we could have from this quite wide open technology, and we are absolutely held back by a very anti-modernist sort of yuck factor, like we don't want to mess with nature. We've been messing with nature since forever.
Anything that is alive messes with nature.
Exactly. Absolutely. There is no balance of nature. Nature is in constant flux. If you speak to any, even conservation biologists, will say, nope, the whole concept of balance of nature is, we don't use that. It doesn't have any scientific validity. Nature is in constant dynamic flux.
Right.
What companies have been up to in the last few hundred years is that we may be endangering the ecological services that are of benefit to humanity. And that's a problem. But the restoration of some perfect, pristine nature that this Arcadia that existed, if it weren't for humanity, it's just not true. Animals themselves, plants themselves, other organisms are constantly transforming nature themselves. They are they're ecological engineers in the same way that we are.
I mean, the one thing that's different maybe now, and that's why it's called the Anthropocene, is that we, one species, is having much more of an impact on the whole world than any one species has had before, right?
That's not strictly true. If you wind the clock back 2.5 billion years to the emergence of cyanobacteria, at this point in the history of life on Earth, almost all life was anaerobic. That is, oxygen was toxic. Cyanobacteria, evolved to and figured out a way, basically, to metabolize and basically, without going into the jargon, basically fart out oxygen. This was an incredible advance for them because it enabled them to do so much more. Basically, they were sort of like, the X-Men, this incredible new superpower compared to all the lethargic bacteria that had existed before, which was great for them, but pretty shitty for every other organism. And almost all of life was wiped out on the planet at this point. It was not merely... It was one of the great extinction. It was a significant extinction event, not merely because of it was called the Great Oxygenation Event, but also because it basically caused a snowball Earth, the very first ice age, which wiped out even more species. So we've been here before. Now, it's fair to say that they did this over about 200 million years, and we've done this a similar sort of transformation of the planet on about 250 years. Mm-hmm. But it's not true to say that this has never happened before. It has. Now, again, this does not in any way mean that we should be okay with this. We're already seeing absolutely terrible effects from climate change. This year alone, we've seen heat waves in Iran and other parts of the Middle East with temperatures that boggle the mind. The deaths from heat waves is horrendous. It was something like 10,000 people died from in what was it 2009 or maybe it was 2006 in Paris. From the heat wave that summer. It's these are real issues that we need to deal with, but we need to deal with them because we're endangering the ecological services that we benefit from. We live in a wonderful sort of Goldilocks sort of temperate Goldilocks period for temperature on the planet. And tipping out of that to making it really, really cold or really, really hot is going to be shitty for us. Now, we're an incredibly adaptive species. We could probably survive. It's not the end of life for humanity, but it's really hard. I mean, we can live using technology at the down the deepest trenches in the oceans. We can live in the vacuum of space in a spacecraft. We can live in Qatar or Saudi Arabia in the middle of the summer in a air conditioned hotel room, but walking down the street is pretty uncomfortable, and you can't walk down the street in down the Mariana Trench. Et cetera, et cetera. We're incredibly adaptive, but do we really want to be living in a super warm planet that where everywhere is like Saudi Arabia? No, we don't. I mean, that's a sort of extreme version of what I don't want to exaggerate things either. So we do need to take climate change very seriously. It's already having terrible effects for us as a species.
Right, but it's not because we're unique as a species that this is happening.
No.
It's just, not utterly unique. It's just, it is happening, and now it's up to us to try to hopefully be smarter than those one-celled organisms billions of years ago and do something about it.
Thank you for joining us. Tonight, for our interview, we have Cyanobacterium. Now, you are making quite a change in the world. In fact, one might even say that the very air we breathe is being changed by you. Tell me, were you the first bacterium to perform photosynthesis?
No, in all modesty, I was not the first bacterium to perform photosynthesis. There are different kinds of bacteria which do it in slightly different ways, and including today, there are the purple photosynthetic bacteria. But I use chlorophyll instead to trap the sunlight, and I produce oxygen gas as a waste instead of something like hydrogen
oxidation of the Earth's surface environment. This is known as, amongst geologists, as the Great Oxidation Event. Now, that doesn't mean that the Earth's atmosphere built up as much oxygen as it has today. It's probably a minuscule amount of oxygen, but it's enough oxygen to influence biology, and it's enough oxygen to influence atmospheric chemistry. For example, enough oxygen to create a viable ozone layer that then provides protection from the sun's UV radiation. So the Great Oxidation Event is another huge enigma in geobiology and astrobiology.
I'm hearing you, I understand, but is it okay that I have a backyard chickens? Can I keep those?
You can totally keep your backyard chickens. Now, Goldman Sachs doesn't care if you keep if you raise chickens. This is a t-shirt set, this famous t-shirt says. I love craft beer. I love going to farmers markets. I'm a real foodie. My brother's was a chef. I care deeply about good food, but it's an aesthetic choice. It's not a virtue. It's not a better way of living. It's certainly not a solution to the climate crisis. In fact, if anything, local food production, because it is by definition much more extensive than intensive agriculture, use up much more land, and the number one cause of carbon emissions from agriculture is land use change. So scaled up to a global level, if we switch back to local, smallest, beautiful, sort of extensive agriculture as the Greens suggest, it would be terrible for the climate, because it would produce so much more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
Yeah, I mean, there was a guy who, Dmitry Orlov, you ever heard of Dmitry Orlov? Now, he's a guy who's all for back to the land and back to small farming, and he would talk about the importance of kitchen sink farms or, you know, backyard farms and that kind of thing. But he lives on a sailboat and he's waiting for the apocalypse and he can sail away. But the thing to think about when it comes to, if you really listen carefully to people who are advocating for getting back to nature on that level of just subsistence farming and kind of tribal life, they are all relying on the idea that most humanity will die out. These are not our friends, okay?
No, Derek Jensen is quite, I mean, again, Derek Jensen is almost admirable in that he consistently runs to the logical conclusions of his arguments. And he's quite upfront. Yeah, what we're talking about will result in the death of billions. And he's perfectly happy with that. He's perfectly comfortable with that. He views humanity as a curse, as that we are vermin, that we are a scourge on the earth. This is horrific. You're absolutely right. These people are not our friends. We are humanists. We believe fundamentally, what do socialists believe? We believe we are amazing species, so clever that we can run the economy ourselves democratically. We don't have to wait for elites to run our economy. We fundamentally love humanity. We're aware of how clever we are. And the argument that I make in the book is, as far as we know, we haven't discovered life on any other planets yet. So we certainly haven't discovered any intelligent life anywhere else. As far as we know, we are the only intelligent, the only conscious life in the universe. That means that we are the universe becoming aware of itself. After 13.8 billion years of a completely unconscious universe, the universe is now able to look out at itself and be aware of itself. We are the most precious thing in the universe. You don't have to be religious. I mean, this is a sort of very scientific humanist.
You sound like a goddamn hippie. Go on.
The universe. What a concept.
You know, the universe is a little bit like the human hand. For example, you have Grauman's center right here, and then you have Undiscovered Worlds and Sector 8, and up here it's the Tillman's Crest. So you can kind of picture that it's a little bit like a leaf or it's not a bowl.
The universe is beautiful.
Placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires. Speak glowingly of those greater than yourself, and heed well their advice, even though they be turkeys. Know what to kiss and when. Consider that two wrongs never make a right, but the three do. Wherever possible, put people on hold. Be comforted that in the face of all aridity and disillusionment, and despite the changing fortunes of time, there is always a big future in computer maintenance.
You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. Whether you can hear it or not, the universe.
Fate of the universe is so dark and mysterious that it generates butterflies in my stomach, and that goes to tickles in my spine, and that creates goose pimples, and then that penetrates my mind, and then the whole Big Bang
far from a cold technocratic vision that sometimes I'm accused of, there's a wonderful romance to this. And the open-ended possibilities that have yet to be tapped of what humanity can do. This goes back to the arguments around economic growth in the book, which is another fundamental thing. Turning back to Marx and the grand tradition of progressive authors, the argument has historically been that why did Marx think that that capitalism was a transitory mode of production? Fundamentally, because production was fettered. He felt this doesn't make any sense. There's right. So much more possibility here, so much more freedom that humans can have from drudgery, enabling us to have more and more time to pursue our life plans. The unknown, the Rumsfeldian unknown unknowns of what we could achieve if production became unfettered.
So one last question, and then I think we'll maybe have one more after that, and then wrap it up.
Okay.
Do you think that part of the reason why this sort of Malthusian, which we haven't even talked about Malthusians, but this Malthusian approach, this sort of anti-human approach, is popular on the left is because of something other than the actual problems that we're facing? Like, it has to do with a need people have for religious conviction or religious feelings, or you know, a need people have to feel superior to others, or worry about sin and original sin in humanity, or is it a religious impulse?
No, well, I mean, perhaps in some sort of superstructural way, but I'm fundamentally materialist, and I do want to try to empirically identify make a hypothesis as to where this has come from. And the argument that I make, or rather the hypothesis I'm putting forward, is, as I mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation, the Jamesonian quote that Zizek makes over and over again, that it is easier to imagine the end of civilization than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
Right.
It is easier, sometimes framed as, it is easier to imagine the end of the planet, the end of the planet, than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. This is it. It's the Thatcherite Tina. There is no alternative. The future has been cancelled. The utopian project, it has been abandoned, or the future-oriented utopian project has been abandoned. The only location where we can find our utopias are now in the past. I think that's the argument I'm making there.
And it's been canceled by an economic change, by neoliberalism.
Yeah, the changes that happened in the 1970s, the failure of, or the reaching the limits of Keynesian economics, the crisis that happened at this point, the response by elites to that was neoliberalism, and then that sort of compounded the death blow. Basically, was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I'm an anti-Stalinist. I think I'm absolutely. It's a good thing that the Soviet Union no longer exists. But at the same time, we have to recognize that the idea that it, even however much, however bad it was, it still kept an idea alive in the heads of the bourgeoisie, of the ruling class, that if we go too far, the game's over. And amongst people, whether they were socialists or not, of that another world is possible, that something else is viable. Now, those other worlds are foreclosed, both amongst the popular classes and amongst elites. They don't have to fight any. They don't have to worry. The utopia has been canceled, and so now the only location where there is hope is a retreat. That's the argument that I make, rather than it's a sort of religious cast of mind, although in some cases it is. It is fundamentally it's a product of the world historic defeat of the working class in the late 70s, early 80s. That's what I think has happened.
Is there a split in the environmentalist left? There are many, many people think like you, and then many others who are kind of on the anti-science, anti-humanity.
There is, I think that there's a growing number of progressives particularly around Jacobin magazine that I write for quite regularly, a few other locations where people are getting very, very frustrated with identity politics and postmodernism and are trying to feel their way towards a 21st century revival of, traditional sort of Marxist universalist argument. At the same time, many of these people, although it's not completely overlapping, also have a very deep frustration with the elitism of and just scientific illiteracy of a lot of the green left, and are sort of, again, sort of reaching towards a sort of more modernist left-wing vision. That there's that, and a lot of these people, I think they're lovely people. They have a great sense of humor, and I have a lot of hope that a revival of a modernist humanist left is certainly on the cards. Beyond that, I think within a sort of liberal left perspective, there's a lot of people, the eco-modernists around the Breakthrough Institute. There's another bloggers and a number of other characters internationally that are and that sort of the Breakthrough Institute is out of San Francisco, but we see this in the UK and France and elsewhere as well, where people are genuinely very concerned about climate change and biodiversity loss, but are looking at the science and the energy policy analysis and saying, look, this just doesn't make sense. The smallest beautiful stuff is just the wrong way to go about doing things. And they are also opting for a high technology modernist approach to solving and actually, very public sector Keynesian approach to solving these issues. I mean, my day job, I'm a science writer. I speak to climate scientists on a regular basis. Within this realm, people are incredibly frustrated because they see environmentalists as a sometime ally and sometimes enemy, because they cherry pick the science. They pick and choose which bits of science they like and which bits of science they don't like. So there's an enormous frustration within the scientific community as well at the sort of anti-scientific left. I think there's a burgeoning group of people coming from a range of different areas that are beginning to be quite frustrated with the anti-modernist cast of contemporary culture.
It's time once again for Ask Manson, starring America's favorite answer man, Charles Manson.
The best way to change things.
I get back to the horse. If you don't get back to the horse, there's going to be nothing left of you. Now, it's dawning in the minds of many. It's dawning in the minds of chemistry. It's dawning in the minds of biology. And I got 7 big locks in my brain, you dig? And then I send off to Norway. Sure. And I send him a thought, and it goes to Norway, and the chemistry, and they're looking in the little things. You dig what I'm saying? And then I'm over here in Australia sitting on a bushman. I don't need a telephone to communicate with that bushman. You dig what I'm saying? That bushman is right inside my soul, man. He's right inside. I can hear everything. I can see through his eyes. You see what I'm saying? It's like I am that bushman.
Ask Manson was brought to you by Happy Children's Toys, fun for all ages.